Car washes were booming. Private equity was paying up. So why would two seasoned developers sell, pivot, and bet big on Class A climate-controlled storage? Today, we're pulling back the curtain on a built-to-core self-storage model that garners the interest of big names in storage space, such as Public Storage, Extra Space, and CubeSmart, just to name a few. I'm Kevin Bupp, and this is the Real Estate Investing for Cashflow podcast, where we go beyond headlines to unpack the playbooks of operators building durable income and long-term value. Here's what's coming up. First, the blueprint. Why 70 to 90,000 net rentable square feet, full climate control, and a drive-through design make big players actually want to manage your asset. And later in the show, we're going to discuss how entitlements turn not-so-valuable dirt into a prized asset with real equity. And then lastly, we're going to talk about when to pull the ripcord on a deal and eat $30,000 to $40,000 in pursuit cost. Our guests are Bill Canadas and Ben Salzberg, co-founders of Self Storage Developers. Bill's a finance-first developer with decades across retail, office, and housing. Ben's a Six Sigma operations vet who saved Fortune 500 companies nine figures and now applies that rigor to national storage builds. Together, they've shifted from express car washes to institutional-grade storage run by third-party publicly traded operators. So let's go ahead and dive into the show. My friends, how are you doing today? Welcome to the show.
I'm doing great. Thank you so much for having us on the show.
Yeah, Kevin, thank you so much.
Excited to have you guys here. Excited to talk shop. Pull back the curtain, learn a little more about your background, your business. And, you know, you guys are in self-storage today, but you've got a background prior to that, right? And so how about we start there before we dive into the mechanics of what your business looks like today in the self-storage space. Again, you both came out of the express car wash development side of things before moving to self-storage. So I guess let's start there. You know, what made you realize, or when did you come to the realization that storage was a better long-term play?
Gosh, that's a great question. I think we were looking at self-storage facilities for years. Prior to even doing car washes, we develop strip centers, office buildings, office condos, and then got involved into the express car wash model. Obviously, car wash has been around for a long time, since the 60s. The express model came much later when people realized that it was very, very labor intense, right? Your car washes in the 60s are not the car washes of today. And most modern car washes now have a tunnel system and usually one or two employees that are working there. And they're primarily watching the pay stations to make sure that they don't break down or the facility breaks down. That was a great endeavor we did for several years. What's interesting about the self-storage model, at least from our opinion, is you have the major REITs that are operating that, where the car washes, you still don't have major REITs that are operating those. You have a lot of family owned or even investment private equity groups that own maybe 100 of them across the country. I think there's like 60,000 car washes in the United States these days. So there's obviously different groups that own them, as well as the mom and pas. But when you talk about self-storage, you're talking about publicly traded big companies like your Public Storage or your Extra Space Storage, CubeSmarts, that are operating these. And I think that's kind of why we've pivoted out of that car wash and into more of the institutional REIT properties and asset classes.
Anyone that's tuning in here now, I mean, I guess unless you live out in the middle of like Montana or Wyoming, some rural market, more than likely, if you're in a somewhat of a prime market, you probably have at least one, if not, maybe even, dozens of car washes that have opened up in your general vicinity, in your MSA over the last couple of years. It seems like the last 5 years have been the absolute heyday for new car wash developments. And maybe that's just my perspective. I'm down in the Tampa Bay area and they're everywhere. I mean, to the extent where there's a few that are struggling because there's, five more, within a mile stretch on the same, same road. And so, there's an oversupply from what I've seen, but, maybe there's other markets where that's just not the case. So I guess where I'm going with that question is, the boom has been real. And I think everyone has seen the boom in the car wash industry in the past, really the past 5 years. It seems like it's been on rocket fuel. Lots of private equity getting into space, trying to gobble up as many as they can. What was the, what was the reason for the pivot in 2021 when, seemingly car washes were on fire in a good way?
Here in Illinois, we had COVID that happened back then, right? So some states had a, closed action where the businesses needed to close. So right at that moment, we were all trying to figure out what we're going to do, right? We had closed down the operations. PPP money was being sent to everybody. And just for us personally, we had other partners. It wasn't just Ben and I. We had an investment group in at that time as well. and everybody's trying to figure out how to get out of some of their investments and trying to figure out where they're going to go to. So it was a perfect timing. Private equity was looking to get in, and we were looking at other opportunities. So they came in with a nice check size, wanting to buy everybody out. The part of the original founding members stayed in. They're the operating partners, and to this day, they still operate them, and we're close friends with them. So they stayed in with private equity, and Ben and I and a couple other partners got out.
You know, anything you do in life, Kevin, is about location, 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 right? And so even though you mean car washes are saturated in some markets, but other markets are not. And so, you know, people who are in it, you know, that want to be in that market may be great for them, you know, depending on where they're at. You know, we are real estate commercial brokers too. So we do a lot of, you know, analyzing every day, you know, where we're putting our self-storage facilities.
And they're still doing very well. I mean, when we left, when we sold our position out, we had four that were open and operating, two that were under construction. And today, I think they have 12 or 13 that are operating. So they continued with that model. It's still doing very well for them. They're great operators. So that also obviously has a big play with any business, right? You have to have good operations. So good group of guys.
Ben and Bill, give us a better understanding of your firm. You know, I guess what respective roles each of you guys play in the self-storage arena, you know, underneath your firm's brand. You know, I guess this, so we can better understand you individually, where your skill sets lie and how you guys apply them to the self-storage space. So
I'm an engineer, mechanical engineer education, MBA, specialized in quality. I'm also a teacher. So I do a lot of the, most of the operations. And, you know, I look at the engineering work that has to be done, the you know, getting all the labor, analyzing all the different aspects of the project and facilitating, you know, and looking to make sure that we have a proper process in place. And so based on my background, I've been doing operations engineering for, I don't know, 30 years, 28 years with problem solving. I'm a Six Sigma specialist since the inception of Motorola. I was class number one. I saved companies over $100 million. I used to lead our Amtrak, ADP, Abbott, AbbVie. And and you know, real estate to me is fantastic. I love it. It's about people because I love people. And, you know, Bill and I, you know, met a while back, but Bill's a smart cookie. He is the CFO of the company. And so we, you know, work hand in hand.
Thank you, Ben. How about yourself, Bill?
So my background is in financing and development. I started developing about 30 years ago, but I started off by purchasing a residential mortgage company, and we had a banking license. So we were able to fund with our own funds on a warehouse line and then sell it on the secondary market. And I was always interested in financing and developing, and we got into it kind of by accident. We had a developer that was doing single family homes that came up to us to get some financing. We ended up investing with them and then rolling the financing with them. And from there, we did a lot of the single family homes. As I mentioned earlier, retail strip centers and office buildings. Matter of fact, we had done something in St. Petersburg, Florida. I used to come down to Tampa all the time myself. I was on a board of directors of a company back in the day, helping them with some financing. So financing has always been something that I loved and pursued. So as Ben mentioned, I took the role on as the CFO. We work on things together. I mean, the reality is, you know, we both go to the meetings with the villages and we work with the local politicians and work with our design team. And we have a lot of consultants that we work that are really more family than anything else. They're really our internal team of consultants that work with us who are not only in the business, but they also own self-storage facilities themselves. So we're in a good space with some really good people.
If you have good people around you, you make good projects and products. And that's what we do. You know, that's what we do best.
Help us better understand the business model. Are you developing underneath the umbrella of a larger brand, or do you have your own independent brand? How does that work?
Sure. So we develop under a different brand, and this is not a franchise model. So it's not like, you know, let's get together and get a Subway or, you know, some kind of other franchise that's available out there. It's third-party management. We like using the REITs. So right now, Ben and I are developing a new project in a suburb of Chicago. We just closed on the land a little over a month ago, and that's going to be a public storage. So under the third-party management, think of it as you own a multifamily, and it's large enough where you need to hire another property manager. The only difference, I would say, is they do all the marketing for it, and the employees belong to them. And then the LLC on a monthly basis would pay back, you know, their cost for their running of their employees. The best part of that is if somebody doesn't show up to work today, you know, if you and I had a Subway together, hypothetically, I always use that as an example, then you and I are over there making sandwiches, where, you know, somebody like Public Storage, because everybody's on the same system, they're able to get into the building, they use the same computers, they have the same revenue model. Somebody can walk in there and actually make a payment for another Public Storage facility if they wanted. And other Public Storage facilities can also, you know, collect money for somebody that's a tenant in our building. So it's definitely a third party, but it's not a flag. It's not like a Marriott hotel or, like we said, a franchise model.
How does that work? So using that as the example, Public Storage, you're going to use them as a third party operator. Are you required to build to certain specs that fit kind of their build box before they'll agree to take on third party management? And are there any, you know, future obligations that you have to that brand as it relates to like a first right of purchase, you know, if you decide to sell at some point in the future?
Yeah, that's a great question. So, there is some of the design features that you want to incorporate when you're doing a public storage, and some developers do one that's more of a vanilla envelope. That way they don't know until last minute if they're going to go public or ExtraSpace or CubeSmart. They may leave the colors out, and then the sign will kind of really identify you as what operator you are. But one of the things is the office is a perfect example. They want it a certain way. So if an employee from Public Storage goes into another one, it's set up the exact same way. You're going to have their system set up the same way. You're going to have their key fobs for entry into the building a certain way. So those are expenses that you're going to have to lay out up front. Hopefully, you know what operator you're going to go with, so you use the systems that they have in place. Other than that, one of the things that you want to look at is you want to make it big enough so it is an institutional grade. You also want to build it so it's a Class A facility. All of our facilities are climate controlled. The new one that Ben and I are doing is a full drive-through. You drive in one end and come out the other end. But we try to have a minimum of 70,000 of net rentable square feet, so it's considered to be operated by a REIT, or they want to operate it, I should say. But ours are typically over 90,000 square feet. So if you're going to be looking to develop one that's going to be operated by one of the big boys, you want to develop north of 70,000 square feet. And then you try to work with them part of the design build, because they have a lot of influence, like, the office doesn't really look good there. It'd be better if you had it over here, or, you know, move the bathrooms here so the manager can use it. So we get their input on it. But at the end of the day, you own it. You know, they don't own it. They'll operate it if it's in the market they want to be in.
And they just don't take anyone, Kevin.
Of course not.
I mean, we have relationships you have to build. You have to, you know, make sure that all the analytics are properly set in line with their analytics. So it's not like even if you do an A-class facility that they'll take you. That's not correct. There's a lot of back work that has to be done.
Yeah, we've heard stories from other developers that thought this was the best project in the world. They didn't consult with any of the big boys that built it. And then they said to them, okay, you know, we're opening up in 60 days. Let's talk about doing it. And they're like, I'm sorry, but we're not A, in this market. B, we're oversaturated, because they don't want to fail, right? I mean, it's good to make, you know, 4%, 5%, 6%, whatever they charge as a management fee. But at the end of the day, that's not really what they're all about. The end of the day, these third-party management companies are inside there operating for you with hopefully the goal to one day maybe buy it from you, right? But they're not going to buy anything just because it's there.
Yeah, no, you bring up a great point. We'd love to talk about that a little bit, and as it relates to location, right? Location is everything with real estate. You know, how involved are these larger brands with giving you direction? Like, hey, Ben, Bill, we want to be in these respective submarkets. Like, so if you find something there that you know fits our buy box, you can buy the land at the right price. You know, we'll do the deal. Do they give you guidance like that? Is there parameters that they set forth that you guys can simply go hunting?
We have to do all the running and the hard work, you know. That's
okay,
all of it. But and tying up the property, I don't know their politics, obviously, but I'm guessing with a company that's a publicly traded company, they're not sitting there saying, hey guys, we're pointing you in the right direction, go build it and we'll buy it one day. I mean, there's just a lot of things that go into these, but no, the short answer is they don't give you any of the guidance. Ben and I find the pockets. We have our own analytics. Ben is great at finding projects and doing the analytics on it. Once we do that and we love it, then we talk to our consultants and run it through the second, you know, ringer through them, make sure that they like it. And then we'll sit down with Public Storage or Extra or Cube, whatever it is, and just say, what do you guys think of this market? But we kind of know before we go to them what they're going to say, because we know they're in the market. We know what they're getting from the rents. We know if there's a demand. So we're doing all of our homework. We're not just saying, here's 20 properties. Tell us which is the best one. They don't got time for that.
Give us some of the priority checkboxes of what you guys are looking for to determine whether or not a market's viable.
Yeah, I mean, we looked, for rental, how many people are renting the area, population. We look at how far other self-storage facilities are in a 3-mile radius. I mean, that's big, right? You don't want to be competing against with 100 other people with the same, opening up. You don't want to do that. How the traffic counts, right? How much traffic is going by your facilities? And per capita, the square footage per person in the population. So, we do what's called around 7 per capita. We look around that or less. There are a lot of analytics. So when you find a storage facility, or when I find a storage facility in an area, I'm like, great, I love it. And then you look at, the traffic area or the rental community is like 2% in the area. Well, you don't want that.
You want more renters than homeowners. Okay. Is it 40% renters, 60% homeowners? Like that's a good ratio. Or is there general rules of thumbs that you guys go by quick and dirty? Like if it was only 30% renters, you're like, there's no way, that's never going to work. Is there a certain floor that you guys are looking for to push you into like, okay, well, this, we check this one box, makes enough sense to continue moving forward and taking a deeper dive into this to see if it checks all of our boxes and could become a potential viable prospect.
It all depends. You have those checks and balances. You may have a good rental rates with low renters. So you may have, it all depends.
What type of market is $4 per square foot? Are there, what markets are we, is that like in LA or like a New York City?
Yeah,
like,
San Diego.
$4 a foot. Wow. So for some context, everyone knows like what a typical 10 by 10 unit looks like, right? Like that's the most common, floor plan, I would say. And correct me if I'm wrong. I think probably 5 by 10 and a 10 by 10, but like, a 10 by 10 space, $400 a month. Like that's insanity. But I guess if you live in a expensive market like San Diego, then that's just the norm.
Think about this. You have a condo and you're paying X amount of dollars for a condo, right? And then it's cheaper to rent than to, to buy more room in the condo. It's cheaper to rent, even at $4 square foot.
We're data driven. Ben touched on these points around population density, income levels. One of the things is competition saturation that, we look at. So to Ben's point, you got to look at everything, right? So basically every project starts with solving a problem. So what is the problem in that community? There's a lot of renters. They may need more space, right? Or we were in a community where the mayor said, hey, the homes across the street has a homeowners association that don't allow them to park their cars or their boats there. And where are they going to put that stuff? So they needed more exterior space where they don't have any basements, right? So give you an example in Arizona or in Las Vegas that are being built without basements, they're going to need more storage. And that is less renters, but homes without basements. So there's just so many factors that you really got to look into when you're putting this whole piece together. It's like a lasagna, right?
I guess in the last, since rates have taken a steep climb, they're starting to come back down again slowly but surely. But obviously the last couple of years have been fairly stagnant as it relates to folks moving, new supply coming out of the market and getting absorbed. Just in some markets, there's oversupply of a multifamily product or even single family homes that will take time. It will get absorbed and the population will kind of fill in those gaps. But how has that impacted, directly within your business itself? Have you guys seen impact on some of your projects that just haven't necessarily hit the mark as far as projections and pro formas as it relates to the slowdown that's occurred the last couple of years?
I think that the slowdown occurred before, after COVID, but it's actually inclining as far as the rates are going back up.
You talking about the rates per foot, rents per foot. Is that what you're referencing?
Yeah, correct.
I guess what I meant is like with less people moving, there not as many folks are moving from household to household. They're like, they're staying put a little bit longer. Like the data shows that folks are, there's more renewals of leases than new leases being signed, right? So people are kind of to stay put at this point in time, just, you know, not as much movement that maybe was happening during the late, you know, latter half of 2020, 2021, 2022. You know, the economy has just slowed down quite a bit. Has that impacted the self-storage industry at all, or more specifically, your business?
Short answer is yes, but not a lot. And I'll tell you why. And it's because we're not only relying on people moving for self-storage, right? So Ben will tell you, you know, in the self-storage, you know, arena, we talk about the four Ds. So you got death, divorce, dislocation, and downsizing. So downsizing is where people are moving, right? But people are going to die. And, you know, the kids are trying to put their stuff in storage till they decide what they're going to do with it. I have got friends that have kids that are still in college, and they're always using storage in between the summertime as they're moving between the houses and the frats and all that stuff. You got divorce. Unfortunately, it happens, and people need to put stuff in storage. Dislocation, people are moving, right? So they're moving from one job to another job. So it's not just the moving of the household. There's other people, there's businesses that might be closing that they need to put their stuff away, right? So it's not just the housing market per se. It is a factor, don't get me wrong, but it's not, you know, 100% of our business. If it was, I think that would give us more more problems. You know, keep in mind, I think self-storage is probably the only asset class that is resilient, you know, to good times and bad times, right? It's always there. People have been using it since the 70s, and it seems to, you know, been out living and out performing every other asset class.
Fair points there. Although manufactured housing, I think, takes the trophy on that one, but that's for another time.
We want to do a show to invest with you guys.
Yeah. Yeah. Would love to understand your process through the, not necessarily just through the entitlement process, but you know, you've got to get really good being developers at winning over, you know, municipalities, local communities, neighborhoods that are surrounding an area that you're looking to develop. Like there's a lot, I think you guys probably sharing some of the same skepticism, probably not nearly as much, but probably somewhat similar as maybe what we do in the manufactured housing space. Like you got the whole NIMBY syndrome, not in my backyard. You got municipalities that you know, they might envision one thing of what your finished product is going to look like, which is far, far, far from what reality is going to be, right? Like they're envisioning this ugly metal box with this, you know, 90 degree square corners and, you know, no aesthetic appeal whatsoever. And that's just the farthest from the truth, right? There's some, you know, gorgeous self-storage facilities that are stuccoed and finished nice and pretty. And you wouldn't even know that it's a self-storage facility unless you actually were renting from it, right? You drove into it and went inside. What are some of the biggest misconceptions then that city officials have, and how have you guys been able to overcome them and get approval and get support from these local municipalities?
The cities, you know, I said earlier, you know, you got there's a problem that you need to solve, right? So when you sit down with the village, and I'll say Ben does a great job when we sit down with the villages. Ben's an elected official for the last 9 years for a college. He ran for state senate. So, but he's not afraid of politics, and he's not afraid to sit down and talk about what is it your constituents need, right? There is a need here. So we're not trying to cram it down their throat. When we were doing the car washes, that was a whole different story, because they're worried that you're going to have your, you know, your 60s, cars out there with loud music and everybody's going to get together. So you had to overcome that, or the vacuums are going to be so loud that the neighbors are going to complain. But when it comes to storage facilities, you know, you don't have a lot of traffic, right? You're not having tons of cars pulling in and pulling out. So it's pretty quiet for the neighborhood. The one thing that the villages would like to have, it doesn't create taxes for them, like sales taxes, but sometimes there's other options that you could put in there in place to bring some revenue to them. But when we look for our developments, we look for areas that might be blighted, right? That we're helping them. Maybe it's a property that we can redevelop that was a closed down big box that might be closed for 3 or 4 years, where they would welcome some new life in there. The one that we're doing right now, it had EPA issues. So we sat down with the village and said, this has been a dump for the last, you know, 30 years. Do you want some developer to come in there and clean it up? Because I think you do. So I'll tell you what, why don't we develop it? And we were able to put it in a TIF. They had a TIF already that they were planning on doing it. So it kind of got expanded to include us. And we were able to get some tax incentives there that benefit the village. So to Ben's point is, you got to sit down with the village and find a piece of property that they really need to see developed, right? And I have a picture, you can't see it, it's on the other side of my desk, of a building that has multifamily on floors 3, 4, and 5. And on floors 1 and 2 is self-storage. But the way it's designed on the first floor, we also have, you know, like a T-Mobile or a Verizon that does generate sales tax dollars from, or it might have a Dunkin' Donuts with the drive-through that's going to bring in the volume. So we think outside the box all the times when we're meeting with these villages. You know, what is it that we do for you?
Right. It's all about working with the community, Kevin, right? And so we can work together and sync with the community and their master plan and make sure it fits in the organization rather than cram it down their throat. That's the better way to do it.
And are you guys typically going in and grabbing, you know, fully entitled shovel-ready land, or are you getting it far before that and running through the entire entitlement process?
Ben and I love to run into the wall.
Yeah, we like to do the hard route, the hard way. We like to entitle it. We like to get everything done ourselves.
So truth be told, it takes a lot of work to do that, as you probably already know, but you're creating value, right? So that value is you know, down the line also equates to equity. So when you're raising equity for all these deals, Ben and I more than likely have a lot of money. Not only do we spend our time and effort into it, but once you get it entitled, that property is worth more money. Sometimes we're lucky to put it into a TIF or get into a tax incentive program like a 7B, which is a property tax. That keeps increasing the value of it. So yeah, we start from scratch.
You're absolutely right. I mean, that's where a lot of the value is made. Obviously, there's some risk associated with that as well, because not every deal, you know, makes it all the way through the entitlement process. And there's some pursuit cost and just sunk costs that, you know, are just the cost of doing business is the best way to put it, right?
That's right.
But the winners, yeah, is there, you know, is it so long as we get one out of three, one out of two, one out of five, like, is there a general rule of thumb of how many successful deals as far as like raw land all the way through the entitlement process to those that, you know, you hit too many brick walls, you're like, this is dead. Let's turn our focus away from this one. We've already sunk enough money and we just don't see an end in sight. Is there a general rule of thumb that you guys roll by?
I don't think so. I think the good news for Ben and I, we're, you know, we decide on stuff and we've never had an argument. We agree pretty quickly. His office is next to mine, so I get to walk over there and he walks over here. So I guess the point is we've done several where we backed out and we try to back out before you lose the earnest money, but we do have sunken costs. So you do spend money either on a phase one or phase two or boring samples. So you may walk away from $30,000 or $40,000, but at the end of the day, that's nothing when you're building $15 million facilities. I'd rather walk away from $30,000 or $40,000 all day long then pursue this to the end, right?
So you guys have been at this development thing for a number of decades. You'd mentioned you've developed, you know, car wash and stuff, storage. I think you said office, retail. There's a litany of things, right? I would have to say that every developer, especially someone that's been at it for as many years as you guys have, you've at least got one deal, probably more than one, but at least one that didn't go as planned. Can you share a project where things went sideways and you know, what did go sideways and ultimately what did you learn from the experience?
A couple of things, I guess, pre-07 when, you know, the world came to a crash, I was holding a lot of vacant land that was approved for single family residences that we built a whole community. So, but there was nothing we could have done. I mean, nobody would have predicted that, right? So we took them through the entitlement process. We got them developed. I had at that time also built, we were doing office condos where we had pre-sold to doctors and lawyers. So we used those commitments to finance those deals. And then obviously when 07, you know, started happening, 08, and everybody started walking away from contracts, but nobody could have predicted that. The second one also nobody could have predicted was COVID. So, you know, we had an office building fully leased. It was humming, doing great. And then all of a sudden COVID hit. And at the same time, we also owned the car washes. Now, the car washes didn't go bad, but like I said, mentioned earlier, we had to close down for about a month while they were trying to figure out what this COVID was. So both of those events were something that we hope we never see again. What did I learn? You know, what did we learn from that? I guess, you know, don't hold on to raw land too long.
Obviously, what did the years following 08, what ultimately occurred with the raw land that you guys were holding on to? I mean, were you able to hold on to it long enough until the values at least rebounded a little bit where you could get out whole? Or, you know, just what did those, you know, 2009, 10, 11, 12, what did they look like?
No, we did not. I'll be honest with you. So I think a lot of people got their asses kicked in that year as developers. So I recall one piece of property that we purchased for $4 million and less than 3 months later, it dropped from $4 million value to $3 million value. And the lender asked us to bring in and shore it up with $1 million, which we did because you had to do it. Nobody knew how long it was going to take. So the good news is, you know, at that point, everybody was trying to sell off the assets and get what they can. And everybody, you know, had a reshift. So we repositioned ourselves and we then started buying assets that were value add. So we were buying something that we can buy and bring value and turn it around, which we did. We bought a shopping center. I don't remember the price. I want to say we purchased it for $3 or $4 million out of bankruptcy. And by the time we leased it up and sold it off, I think we'd flipped it for $8 or $9 million. You know, like everybody else, you have to shift your business plan, right? Because you just don't know. It's really important to be open. And Ben and I have that relationship with everybody that we can just pivot and shift.
It's all about being agile. It's all about being, you know, problem solving. You know, this is what this business is all about. You know, problem solving, seeing what you currently have, looking at the data, looking at the market, and doing the best you can.
So let's talk about the next 5 years, you know, the bigger picture. You know, what are you guys most excited about? You know, what does the firm look like 5 years from now as far as, you know, geographical footprint? Is there an end in sight to where, hey, we're going to roll out this, you know, full steam ahead for 5 years, 10 years, and then we're going to wrap it all up with a pretty bow and we're going to sell it off and, you know, go relax on, you know, in the Caribbean somewhere. What's the plan?
Nothing relaxing, continuously building self-storage facilities. You know, I like this product. I like the asset type. And for me, building.
You know, I've been blessed to have a good life as a serial entrepreneur. And I started 30 years ago, but I was doing my own thing for years. And every time I got into an adventure back when I was younger, a lot younger, all my partners were always older. And what I learned from them is you'll never retire. It's true. Because once you retire, then what do you got to look forward to? So you want to get to the point where you have enough cash like everybody else, right? You know, what's the old saying, mailbox money, where you have a check coming every month and you still get to invest and still develop, but you're not relying on that, right? So that's my goal. So I'm 60. I want to be 80 years old and not coming to work every day. I want to be traveling and enjoying my life, but I want to be able to invest with other younger people that got the next best thing, right?
I love it. Well, Bill, Ben, it's really been a pleasure having you guys on the show here today. Appreciate you guys taking some time to share your background, your story, and some insights with us. But before we wrap it up here for the day, is there anything that you'd like to leave our listeners with? Maybe how they could connect with you and learn more about some of your upcoming projects. I mean, do you take in capital from outside sources, or, you know, how do you go about funding your projects?
Yeah, so we do. I mean, we typically look for family offices or funds that are already established or private equity that comes in. So somebody could write a check for $3 or $4 million. But we've done private placements in the past where, you know, minimum investment is $100,000. So we're always open to that. You know, Ben will tell you, and I kind of echo what he says, you know, we love people, right? So if somebody we meet that says, hey, I love self-storage, we'd love to learn more and get involved, we love having these conversations. You know, they can go to our website, www.self-storagedevelopers.com.
If you want, you know, more information, you can go info@self-storagedevelopers.com and you can email us and I'd love to talk with everyone.
That's fantastic. I appreciate you guys and appreciate you coming on the show. And, you know, for everyone, you know, tuning in, you know, thanks again for listening to the Real Estate Investing for Cash Flow podcast. I'm Kevin Bupp, just, you know, reminding you to keep investing for cash flow and to live inspired. So we'll see you guys next time. Take care.
Thank you, Kevin. Appreciate it.